Over the course of just 4 years, from 2000 to 2004, five young men Jessamyn Ward knew well died young. One of them was her younger brother, Joshua. Although each died in different ways, she came to realize that their deaths were connected to the place where they came from, the Deep South, and the struggles black men in particular faced there. In her new memoir, Men We Reaped, Ms. Ward uses the deaths of these five men to frame her own story and the story of her community, which is still affected by a history of racism and poverty. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Jessamyn Ward, who won the National Book Award in 2011 for her novel, Salvage the Bones, to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Where does the title of the book come from?
It comes from a quote that's attributed to Harriet Tubman. And in it, she's recounting a Civil War battle.
Do you think it remains somewhat relevant to what it's like to be a black male in the South today?
Yes. As soon as I read it, I thought, okay, I want to use this in the book. You know, like, I want to include this because it seemed to me that, you know, that moment in time that she's living through, that moment still has ramifications today. And that's one of the things that I wanted to really bring attention to in the book.
Why do you think the legacy has lasted so long?
Because I think that people forget that history does bear in the present, you know, and I think that, you know, in America, that there's this, you know, myth that we believe in, that everything's equal and that the present is the only moment that matters. And so I think, yeah, that people forget, and that's why it's able to last.
There's that famous statement, the quote from William Faulkner, which has slipped out of my mind, but it's about the past being never being the past, really.
Yeah.
Who were the five men who died?
So the first was my brother, my younger brother. He was killed by a drunk driver. Another one was my cousin. He died in a car accident. And then the other three young men were my friends. And they died from heart attack and then murder and then, death by suicide.
But it's interesting that your brother was the first to die, but you've told the story backward, even though you tell the rest of the story chronologically.
Yes, I told the stories of the young men's deaths backwards. And I when I first thought about writing the story, that's the way that the structure, you know, that telling it came to me. And I tried to sort of figure out, you know, I tried to think about other ways that I could tell the story because I knew that it would be hard for the reader to follow. Something in me balked at doing that.
In the prologue, you write that this is your story just as it is the story of those lost young men, and that this is your family story just as it is your community story. Mm-hmm. But aren't you something of an anomaly in your community? You got out, even if you have decided to return. Mm-hmm. Do you see your life as a reflection of the place where you grew up?
Yes. I mean, I am an anomaly.
How many other people wind up going to major universities? And forget about National Book Awards. That's rare everywhere.
That's true. Not many. But, you know, I feel like, you know, since I've been given these opportunities that it's that part of my responsibility is to return and to claim this history and these stories as my own, you know, and to share them.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town called DeLille, and that's on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi.
And it was once called Wolftown?
Yep, and it was once called Wolftown.
Why did it have that name?
No one knows. And I write about that in the book, you know, because I have my own ideas about why it would be called Wolftown.
There couldn't have been a lot of wolves around.
Well, I don't think that there are wolves, but I think that maybe there were, coyotes or, you know, wolf-like animals in the region.
Well, would we call this the Deep South, considering the fact that it's on the Gulf Coast?
It's about as deep as you can get. It's very deep.
Your friend Roger died in June 2004 from a cocaine-related heart attack. How old was he?
I feel ashamed to admit this, but I am terrible at math. So I haven't done the math on all of their ages, and I really should. He was in his early 20s, though. 23 maybe.
And you're right that shortly before his death, you thought to yourself, I hope nobody dies this summer. Mm-hmm. Why would a thought like that have passed your mind?
Because he was the last of the young men to die. And in 2004, he was the third. You know, my friend Damon, I think, had died in January, I want to say. My cousin CJ had died around a month and a half later. And so that's already two deaths, you know, in that year. And so I was going home for that summer, and I thought, I just hope that no one else dies. But I'd gotten to that point where, my outlook was very pessimistic and also fatalistic.
Now, did he die of an overdose or a heart attack that was related to his use of cocaine?
He had a hereditary heart condition, right? His father had died of a heart attack and also had a heart condition. There was speculation, you know, because everyone knew about his drug use, even though we didn't really talk about it. And so there was speculation that after he died, that's what had contributed to the actual heart attack.
Now, it was cocaine, not crack?
No, not crack.
Well, but cocaine is so much more expensive. Isn't crack usually the drug of choice from poor people?
Yes, but I think, you know, it's something that I write about in the book, that there's this stigma associated with crack, whereas you don't, I mean, there's still a stigma associated with cocaine, you know, in the community, but crack in our community is seen as the worst of the worst, and you avoid it if you can.
You write that many kids are first introduced to drugs in their homes, mm-hmm. by their parents, by their siblings?
Not by their parents. I've heard people, you know, sort of joke about the fact that, you know, where I'm from, because it is rural, you know, it is in the deep South, and there isn't much to do. And so, you know, you sort of grow up in this culture where, I mean, drinking is always really common, you know, and
across all the classes,
yes, across all the classes,
all races,
yep, on all the races, and then and so then it's, you know, people are bored, and it's very easy for, you know, other drugs, I guess, to become sort of a social, activities, I guess.
If you'd grown up poor and white in DeLille, mm-hmm. do you think that you could have had a similar story to tell? I mean, race obviously plays a role,
yes.
in this story, but what you're describing is also just a part of the country that, mm-hmm. In fact, many parts of the country, mm-hmm. that share similar problems.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. I think that I don't know how the drug use would have been like. But I think that maybe I would have had a similar story to tell. I mean, because we're all struggling. There is a definite sort of class element to what I'm working about.
My guest is Jesmyn Ward. Her latest book is a memoir called Men We Reaped. Your friend Damond also died of drug-related circumstances, mm-hmm. as you said. How did he die?
He was murdered. He was shot. He came home from work, and someone was waiting for him, and they shot him when he was on his way into his house from his car.
And you describe him as a hustler in the traditional definition of the word.
Mm-hmm.
Why was he a friend? You don't look like the kind of person who hangs out with a lot of hustlers.
Oh, no, he was. So I have to explain this. I thought I explained it well in the book, but maybe I didn't. By hustler in the traditional sense of the word, I meant that he wasn't hustling drugs. He was a hustler in the respect that he did whatever he needed to do. Mm-hmm. In order to support his family. So he would work any construction jobs, doing yards, handyman jobs, anything that he could find in order to, you know, make money.
And sell drugs as well.
As far as I know, he didn't. Some of the other young men in the book do, but as far as I know, he didn't.
Did the police ever find out who shot him?
No. No, I mean, there was speculation in the community that, you know, he was supposed to testify actually against the drug dealer, and so there was, you know, speculation that that was the reason that he was shot, but the police were never able to solve his murder.
Were you close to your brother Joshua?
I was very close to him.
You write that you felt like his little sister, even though you were the older one.
Mm-hmm.
Was he more responsible than you?
Well, I don't. Let me think. He wasn't more responsible than I was. I think the reason that I felt like his little sister and he felt like my older brother was because he, in some ways, he had to mature more quickly than I did. You know, he had to realize very hard truths about what it means to be a black man in the South much earlier and come to terms with them much earlier, you know, than I, you know, had to.
He died when a drunk driver slammed into his car.
Mm-hmm.
The same drunk driver who had forced the sister of your friend Ronald
mm-hmm.
to swerve off the road earlier.
Yes.
The guy's just allowed to go back on the road?
Well, I mean, that's something that we heard from Ronald's sister, that earlier that night that he had made her swerve off the road, but I guess that he wasn't stopped or you know, he wasn't. The police weren't there, and she didn't call in and report it, so he was just still on the road.
And did he go to jail for killing your brother?
Yes. They didn't find the car, and they didn't find him until the morning after. The car that hit my brother. They didn't find the car or him until the morning after. And so he did go to jail, but when his trial, you know, came around, he wasn't charged with manslaughter or he wasn't charged in my brother's death at all. He was charged with, he was convicted of leaving the scene of an accident, and then he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. He served 3 years and 2 months, and then he was out.
Leaving the scene of an accident where somebody died.
Yes, yes, but where somebody died wasn't, it's not even in the language.
Why do you think they didn't pursue him on that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, in the book, I say that, and it's something that I believe. I mean, my brother was expendable, you know, on the surface. I mean, he was a young black man, and the man that hit him was older, and he was white. Society and in our culture looks at them differently. So I think that's part of the reason that they didn't pursue it.
And the fifth man, Ronald, committed suicide.
Yes.
Did he give a reason or did he leave a note?
He did not leave a note. He had a girlfriend and he was having relationship problems. And so when he would have conversations with other people about his, you know, suicidal urges, he would attribute them to the problems that he was encountering in his relationship. But I think that it was something more than that.
A number of reviewers have said that your memoir's most vivid character is your father,
mm-hmm.
whom you love yet soberly observe, mm-hmm. the Times reviewer said. He trained pit bulls.
Yes.
Was dogfighting a popular activity where you grew up?
When I was younger, it was. Now it's not at all. But in the 80s, you know, in the mid to late 80s, it was.
And it almost could have taken your life.
Yes, I was attacked by a pit bull when I was around 6 years old. There was another dog that was there that was in a female dog that was in heat, and I guess I seemed like a threat because I hit, the male dog, my father's dog, that was there, and so my father's dog attacked me. And he was attempting to rip out my throat, but instead he bit me in several places in my head and ripped part of my ear, and also bit me on my back. But the reason that he wasn't able to sort of fatally wound me was because I fought him.
Your father then left the family at a certain point, moved to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother had to work as a domestic. She
mm-hmm.
was the major breadwinner in the family.
Yes.
And you wound up going to a private school.
Mm-hmm.
That had to create a weird kind of tension in the household because there was a class divide within
mm-hmm.
the household.
Yes, yes. It was very odd. You know, I didn't encounter the term double consciousness until I went to college, but that's that's how I understood it. You know, when I thought back on my experience of going to the school where most of the students were white, but then also came from a totally different class than I did.
How did they treat you?
Some of them treated me pretty badly. You know, I mean,
because you were black or because you were poor?
Both.
Your mother was often poor. The person who cleaned their parents' home.
Yes. So, yes, they did. Some of them did.
You eventually left Mississippi to study at Stanford and then University of Michigan. Was it rare for a black kid from DeLille to get a university education?
Well, I think, you know, there were, to get a university education at the caliber of school that I attended, yes. But, you know, I feel like even a lot of people in my mother's generation had some community college. You know, they would, I don't know how many of them actually completed it, but that was something that happened.
And most people who leave just move somewhere else.
Yes,
actually gone back to DeLille?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it because it's such a rich source of material? Your novel, Salvage the Bones, was about a pregnant teenager and a family in the days leading up to Hurricane Katrina, mm-hmm. which actually occurred after the events you write about in this book. Mm-hmm. And you write that you wrote this book to find Joshua, to assert what happened mm-hmm. in a vain attempt to find meaning. Mm-hmm. So is that a reason to continue to live in that community?
I think so. I think that's one of the reasons. And then, you know, that's my center, right? That's where I write from. And then also I think that another reason that I moved home is because, you know, I have a really great family, really close-knit family. I have a really large extended family. And because most of the families in my hometown are related to each other, there's a real sense of community there.
Has much changed over the last 10 years?
Some things have changed, but not a lot.
So similar stories could be told today.
Yes, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book, because I feel like, you know, that if we don't talk about these things and if we aren't frank about these things, then, you know, then they won't change.
Jesmyn Ward will be in conversation with William Jelani Cobb and Khalil Gibran Muhammad tonight at 7 o'clock at the New York Public Library. That's at 42nd Street and 5th Avenue. For more information and to buy tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Her book, her latest book, her follow-up to her National Book Award-winning novel, Salvage the Bones, is called Men We Reaped. It is from Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.